Welcome to Fire Engineering Podcasts, where each day you'll hear a variety of voices speaking on timely topics facing the American Fire Service. The best way to keep up with fire engineering is via our free daily e-newsletter. Learn more at fireengineering.com/e-newsletter.
Hello, everybody. This is Joe Pernesti, and welcome to another edition of In Their Own Words on Fire Engineering Blog Talk Radio. Today, we have Josh Burchick from Howard County, Maryland Fire Department. And Josh wrote an article in the June 2020 magazine. It's titled RIT Activation and Firefighter Optimization. And it's all based out of, we're going to dive a little further because it's all based off of a line of duty death that unfortunately his department suffered in 2018. I believe it's July 23rd. So we're coming up while we're taping this on July 9th, 2020. We're coming up on the 2-year anniversary of the loss of Lieutenant Nathan Flynn. And it happened in a very large single family dwelling. So we'll talk about that and the lessons. And again, I want to thank, as I always do, Bobby Halton and those at Fire Engineering who give me this wonderful opportunity to deliver the authors to you, to let you hear why they wrote the article and their lessons right from their mouths. So Josh, I want to welcome you to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to get the word out, and I appreciate the opportunity sincerely. So thank you for having me.
If you would, tell our listeners a little bit about yourself and the Howard County, Maryland Fire Department, if you would.
Yeah, sure. I'm a Maryland guy, born and raised. Howard County specifically is like smack dab right in the middle of the state. So we're one of the smaller counties in the state. But we also house some of the most affluent zip codes in the whole nation. But that's coupled with having some major thoroughfares throughout, like Route 95 and 70. So we also have our drug epidemic like we had last year, and still some crossover into today. Yeah, there's been some human trafficking cases. We have a really culturally diverse, socioeconomically diverse demographic throughout the entire county. So it's really neat to be able to go from warehouses, commercial. You got your garden apartments. We have our 8,000, 10,000 square foot mansions and everything in between. So it's a really neat mix in such a small area. There's 13 firehouses. We have a couple on the dockets to be built over the next couple of years. There's almost 500 career personnel, and there's a career presence in every single fire station in the county. And we work 24/48. We have a floating Kelly, and I'm at the Banneker station. So I'm pretty much right in the middle of the county. And the station that I'm at specifically runs, our first due produces about, I think last year it was 5,300 emergency incidents out of our first due.
Wow.
You know, the engine is, runs in the high 3,000s, you know, the truck's in the 2s, our medic is, you know, in the low 4,000s. So we're pretty steady firehouse.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay. So let's jump right into the article.
Yeah.
You know, it's all based off of an unfortunate event, but you know, why'd you write it, I guess, is the first question. What spurred you to pen the article?
Well, to be perfectly honest, it was part of FDIC, which okay. This was all new to me. So I had a couple of my mentors and a couple people that I trust, like, hey, you've got a pretty wild story, and I think that you could have a really good message for FDIC. So they kind of pushed me and helped mentor me and coach me through that process. And I was fortunately selected to be a presenter for the 2020 FDIC conference, which, you know, we know is getting pushed back.
We're on hold.
The Yeah, because of COVID. But part of that process, you were required to write an article, which I had no idea about, but it was really good for me to actually get my thoughts down on paper and really try to hammer home a couple of the most important factors that I drew out of my experience. And that was from our line of duty death in Howard County and the subsequent writ operation that my team was involved with.
If you would now, for our listeners who either have not heard about the event, we will post, I will have Pete, who runs the fire engineering website. We will post a link to the report. And so our listeners can go to that if they're unaware of it. But let's, I'll have you give a little bit before we dive into the writ, the article itself and your role in the writ. Take our listeners through exactly what took place that night, the size of the home, and a brief synopsis of what took place.
Yeah, sure. So when I present on this, it probably takes me close to 45 minutes to an hour to really hammer through this. So I'll definitely give you the cliff notes. The night of July 23rd, a pretty big storm came through and we had a bunch of really nasty lightning strikes in the area. Over the course of the evening, we had one lightning strike that took place in Clarksville, in more of the south central section of the county. And this lightning bolt created 10 times more energy than any other lightning strike in the area this evening. And wow. It hit a mature oak tree. It ran down the tree, down through the root system and through the ground. It hit an underground propane tank and then ran the service lines into a home. Wow. And this home was no ordinary home. You're talking, it's over 7,000 square feet. It was 7,300 square feet of main living space and then 1,100 square feet of finished living space just for the basement. So totaling, we're at 8,400 square feet. And the really big thing that that threw this whole incident a curveball was underneath the main level of the home, but above the basement and kind of offset to the side was a near 1,000 square foot, 4 to 5 foot tall crawl space. It was unprotected. It was used as storage. And when the lightning strike ran these service gas lines into the house, it caused it to fault. It arced and it created a pinhole leak, which arced, ignited. And we had a finger of flame resting up against the dimensional lumber there in the crawl space, which would have been the flooring for the first floor. And that finger of flame was just able to eat at those members for 40 minutes before. And granted, this is also happening at 2 a.m.
Right.
So residents are asleep. They don't know what's going on. It takes a long time, obviously, for this home to be volume filled with smoke. And it had a chance to, it took about 40 minutes to present itself just as smoke to the residents. And then that started the dispatch and everything from there. When it initially got dispatched, sorry, yeah, go ahead.
It began in this crawl space, which was 5 feet tall. So it was really basically another floor, if you would. I mean, another.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that was then, just so our listeners can understand, there was a basement then that was somewhat next to it, adjacent to it, that was finished. Correct.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was that 1,100 square foot finished portion of the basement was below grade from side alpha from the front, but from the rear side, Charlie, you had at grade access to the basement. Okay. And then to access this crawl space, you had to go all the way from the backside, all the way through the basement to the front side through a little storage room and go up a half set of steps. And then you found yourself in the crawl space, which was still underneath of the main living portion of the home, like kitchen, family room, dining, from side alpha. So yeah, there's no way we could have known that was there.
Yeah. Okay. So, what is the standard response for a reported fire? Did it come in as a reported fire or an automatic alarm drop or what?
It came in as just smoke in the residence. So okay. Because there's no definitive fire, we treat it as a local box. Some people call it a street assignment. So it's two engines, a truck, a battalion, and a medic. And okay. I think even the safety officer at the time. So they all get there and they smell the smoke before they even get there. They arrive on scene, smoke is showing, and then they upgrade the box. So we get the full box alarm now. So you get your four engines, three special services, you get another battalion chief, and then some staff cars like a EMS officer, the safety officer, things like that. So we have our full box alarm coming. And all of our stuff is staffed with four personnel in the suppression pieces. There were a couple engine companies at the time that still had three. Current day, though, we are at four. And so we had the full box assignment coming. Now, that evening, I was riding engine 71. And 71 was the first engine on the upgrade, so essentially the third due engine.
Okay.
And it's 2 a.m., and I hear smoke in the residence from a lightning strike. I honestly thought it was going to be a low-budget call. I'm thinking mm-hmm. it's going to be some burn-up insulation, maybe some stuff in an attic. But we probably, being the third new engine, we're not really going to be able to play. We're all responding. They go on scene with smoke showing. And so we know it's a little bit more involved. We know it's a larger structure. Mm-hmm. I actually grew up in the area, so I kind of had a general idea of water supply and layouts and the streets. So we end up getting there. And there was also some water supply issues. This one street was a long street that just happened to not have hydrants on the residential section, but out on the main cross street there were. And there's a little bit of confusion just with how some of the first in units were communicating, different upgrades on our mobile data terminals. The chief could tell that there was pools in the back, but other units couldn't see that to use that as a water supply. So we ended up laying out our entire hose bed, long story short. And we even came up 300 feet short, but our drivers made super quick work of it and we never lost water.
Okay.
While this is all happening, the first two engines and truck are basically trying to find this fire. There is a lot of confusion about where it's happening, where they're getting reports. They're getting smoke on the first level. They had heat signatures that they found on their tick when they went in on the main level, but that never got radioed out. They got heat signatures from the floor signifying that they probably had fire underneath of them, but that message never got out to command or responding units.
Okay.
So everybody's thinking they might have a basement fire. So they go around to Side Charlie, they go around to the basement, and there's some smoke, but no real heat or fire. And again, they're having trouble trying to figure out, it's such a large structure. There's smoke everywhere. It's being volume filled. They're just having a hard time trying to figure out where it is. While this is happening, engine 101 officer is walking around Bravo to Charlie and notices that there's now fire showing on the main level of the home. And she radios that over the radio. And so people start booking back up to the upper side of the grade. And that, I need to explain that as well. Inside Charlie, the home kind of makes a slight L or V shape. And all of Side Charlie on the Bravo wing was single story. Mm-hmm. And on the, I guess, Delta side of the wing, there's a gray change. It drops down and you get two stories from the rear, but it's really three stories, even though there's no windows on the backside to denote the upper floor bedrooms. So this gray change that occurs on Side Charlie causes also even more confusion for responding units and for the command officer. When they're saying we're going back up to the main level, the command officer doesn't, at the time was confused about that. Hey, there's this major grade change and all these different at grade access points. So that causes a hiccup as well. Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so, you know, this, and for, again, for our listeners, when you play this, there will be an attachment that you'll be able to kind of look at the report and look at the pictures. But this is a giant house, and I guess going into it, what were some of your so you have a basement fire, you think you have a basement fire, an officer of engine 101, I think it was, somebody radioed that they then had fire on the first floor. So,
yep, exactly.
So they repositioned. At this point in time, what's going through your mind? What are you along the lines of, okay, we got a basement fire, or what was your exact, as they were repositioning now that they found the fire, what was going through your mind? What was your assignment, and what were you thinking?
Yes. Well, I didn't have a whole lot of time to think, and I'll speak on that in a second. When okay. we first got on site Alpha at the front door, we were originally assigned by the command to go in through the front door. And when I opened the front door, the home was filled with smoke. You know, it's a mansion, so we have these big grand foyer. And sure. I used my tick to kind of do a quick scan, and I didn't have any type of indication that this was anything really hot. Like, there was okay. no pressurized heat currents. There was nothing on the floor or any pockets of fire that was giving me any idea that this thing was near me. So I assumed that we were just going to go and search, try to find the fire and do what we could from the top or wherever this fire was showing. Maybe it was in the walls and, you know, climbing up. We just still didn't even really know or have a good indication at this point. What we find out later is that the fire had most likely broken through the crawl space and was showing on the main level. Right before we actually made access, the command officer knew that something wasn't right. He's like, actually, you know what? Units from 7, I'm housed with truck 7 as well. So 71 and truck 7, just hold up right there on site Alpha and just go on deck. That's our lingo for just for being in that ready forward position. And 1 minute and 45 seconds, 1 minute, 42 seconds, depending on which timestamp you use, from us physically being on scene on site Alpha, we hear the Mayday come out. So engine 101 had gone back up to the upper grade of side Charlie. They had made access through one of the, I believe it was laundry or kitchen, and they went in, and there was a hole that had already broken through that main level. And unfortunately, firefighter Flynn fell into that hole as he was advancing the hose line.
He fell into what would be the crawl space, or not the finished basement, but in the storage /
exactly
the crawl space that you described earlier.
Exactly.
So at this point, he radios or someone. Now, before we get into the RID aspect, and again, there's so much to this for our listeners. There is so many things that I do not, you know, Josh can only really touch on the points, but I'm going to say my two cents that if you are a firefighter listening to this, I hope it encourages you to read this report and look at this really in depth, because there are a lot of little dominoes that fell. And that takes me to this, is that when Lieutenant Flynn gave out his Mayday, he was actually transmitting on a different fire ground channel. And so correct. A officer above the hole or whatever that knew he fell transmitted the Mayday for him, correct? He transmitted it, but an officer who knew he fell in on the correct channel transmitted the Mayday also, correct?
Correct, yeah. Okay. The engine 101 officer gave out the Mayday.
Okay.
And at the exact same time, firefighter Flynn gave out his Mayday, but it happened to be on Bravo 2 instead of Bravo 1.
Different fire ground channel.
Okay. Yeah, it was a different fire ground channel, and it's a feature we now have turned off. We had just at the time had recently gone through some radio template changes, and we had a last channel power up feature turned on where it didn't matter how much you toggled your buttons when the radio was off, whatever channel you were on last when the radio was on, that's what you're going to power back up to.
Okay.
And now, granted, I'm only assuming right now, but I know that I've done it plenty of times when we were going through sure. this radio change. Our Alpha 2 channel is our main operations channel for EMS runs and fire alarms and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so we would be operating on Alpha 2. The next call comes out might be a box, so we switch over to a TAC channel. I change my actual channel to the Bravo channel, but I still stay on that two zone. So I would end up on Bravo 2 without toggling back to Bravo 1. I know that I've done that plenty of times, so I can only assume that's what happened to Nate that night. We have since changed that radio template change, but to get back to the point of the matter, he gave out a mayday. It was a really great who, what, where. It was consistent with our training. Out of respect for the family and just the fire service in general, it was, it's apparently a very hard transmission to listen to, but he did a great job, and that's something that only a few will hear, and they're just going to keep that on lockdown.
Sure.
And because it happened at the exact same time as his officer's mayday, nobody heard it. It got trumped by communications and everybody, and they didn't know it until after the fact. Okay. But like you said, our ISRB, our Internal Safety Review Board, did a fantastic job, really not leaving anything unturned. It's a massive project. They did a great job. It's a lot to digest, and there's still a lot more to come. Like, there's the NOSH report we're still waiting on. Adam St. John from the ATF is going to do an amazing fire modeling job that he's still working on. And then I even have my FDIC presentation, which has gotten out there a little bit as well. So there's a lot of good information that really breaks down all these little Perfect. Factors that are at play.
And Adam St. John is also, for our listeners that may know about some other items and some other line of duty deaths in the fire service, he has also did a wonderful modeling of what took place in the apartment fire in Baltimore County.
Yeah. Mark Falkenham.
Yeah, that killed Mark Falkenham. So excellent. Looking forward to that. So
yeah,
RIT is activated, and you are on RIT. Take us through your actions once you know you got a downed firefighter, what you guys' thoughts were and what you did.
Yeah, so the truck crew had formally been assigned RIT, and they went around the Bravo section. We had not been formally assigned RIT, but we knew that we were going to be operating with them, and it was just a matter of time. We go around the Delta side, and myself with the captain made a decision, hey, let's complete this 360 together. We'll split the work. We'll meet back up on the backside. So we do our 360. We put the picture together, start to work a plan together. My crew already had a charged 300-foot attack line at the front door that they redeployed and had it all redeployed within seconds to the backside. So we had water. And we're getting ready to go in, but there's a lot of conflicting reports on who is actually inside. So we were held up for about 4 minutes because there were other missing firefighters and just personnel that weren't accounted for. Okay. After they got the PAR reports, after they figured it all out, we knew that it was just firefighter Flynn that was inside.
How long of a time period of time was there that confusion that you weren't sure? Would you say estimate?
I believe it's 4 minutes.
Okay.
I think it was 4 minutes. I think it was almost 7 minutes from the time the mayday started or was initiated and sounded to the time that we were actually going inside. And that seems like a long time.
Yeah.
But it was, so 3 minutes of that is doing the 360, redeploying the hose line, getting the plan together. And then for about another 4 minutes, we were held up by command. I believe it was my side, Charlie Command, until they got the PAR reports and a location. Now, even with that, though, we only had a minute and 45 seconds from the time we arrived on scene till the time we were like, hey, you're RIT, and the mayday just got dropped.
Wow.
So not a lot of time to prepare ourselves. And it was from the time the mayday was sounded to the time we had firefighter Flynn out of an 8,400 square foot home was 22 minutes and 11 seconds. And from the time we actually made entry, our RIT team made entry to the time we had Nathan out to the waiting EMS crew was 15 minutes and 5 seconds.
Now, so when you entered the home, did you go in the Charlie side into the walkout part of the basement and through to that crawl space then? Or
correct,
we call it a
yeah.
crawl space, but you know, again, for our listeners, this was basically another, I know we're talking 5 foot high ceiling. So, I mean, it's almost like a large cock loft, if you would, on the below. You know, I mean, short. It's the best way I could explain it.
Yeah, no, the first house my wife and I owned, I think it was 1,400 square feet. We could vacuum the entire house without changing plugs. It was awesome. So,
That tells you how big this space is.
Exactly. Yeah, the basement is 1,100 square feet, and the crawl space is about almost 1,000 square feet. So that right there, you add those two together, you're in an average-sized American home.
Right, right.
So yeah, we were given the green light to go. We start on side Charlie of the basement. So we're at grade. We go through the door, and we're not met with a lot of heat, but zero visibility smoke. Mm-hmm. And I could spend minutes and minutes just on how we had to search and what we encountered. But we go from side Charlie, we search all the way back towards side Alpha, and someone calls out, "Hey, I found a set of steps." And we get up to this half set of steps, we go up, we get to the top, and we're immediately met with total blackout conditions and super high heat that just drives us to our knees. And out in front of us, I can hear Flynn's pass device. And so I yell back to the captain and said, "Hey, he's right in front of us, we can go get him." And as I start to move forward, I feel wires pull across my chest. And I remember thinking, okay, this is a terrible, we're already, you know, battling so many things right now. The last thing I want is to feel, you know, wires pull across my chest. And I was about to do like a swim technique and get underneath of it. But then I thought, you know, if we get Nate, we're going to have to pull him right through this mess. And that's not going to be a safe thing to do. So mm-hmm. I take my cutters out. I start cutting away the wires that I could see. And, as all this is happening, the fire's kicking up. The pockets of fire on either side of us. In this crawl space, there is holiday decorations. There's catering equipment, tables, chairs, Costco-sized like pans and just catering equipment for parties of like 60 people or more.
Wow.
So you can just think of all the combustibles and things that are down in there now that are on fire. And it's just that heat that drives you to your knees. And it was a blessing and a curse because I had – enough light to see some of the wiring at times because of the fire, but then that's also the thing that made it really ugly down there. As I clear the space out in front of me, I look over to my lineman, Joey Alessandrini. I said, "You know, Drini, you've got to get this knocked down. It's getting bad in here." And I noticed that he was kind of hunched over in his odd, awkward position that didn't make sense. And I joke about this. I want somebody who could potentially be in the worst position of their life to call their officer and friend, bro. He goes, "Bro, mm-hmm. I'm stuck and the nozzle's stuck. I cannot put out any more fire until I can get this bale freed." And so I start cutting away some of the wires that he had gotten wrapped up in. We free the bale and he's able to start knocking things down. He opens things up and then the captain also is trying to get out of the way. His helmet gets knocked off and he starts getting wrapped in wires. And I can see as he's spinning and trying to get out of it, you can just see the wires kind of cinching down his torso. So I start working on the captain and another one of the truck firefighters, Munyu, and he slides up. He's like, "Dude, I got you. I'm going to help you out." So he continues to help cut away and also free our exit path. And I just remember it being so ugly in there. I was like, "Tell the remaining guys on the crews to single stack on these steps. I'm worried about if this flashes on us, we all need a place to bail. We don't want to hit a stack of bodies if we have to bail." Sure. So he's like, "You know, we're going to clear the wires and we'll make sure we're stacked up neat." The backup guy on 71, Andy Hoffman, he had already advanced forward to find Nate. He had his buddy breathing whip out and he was ready to do just some air procedures if it came to it. But he found Nate. Nate was a well-trained guy. So he had his mask on. He was still on air. You know, you could tell that he had not panicked in such a way where he was removing gear and there was a loss of air. So mm-hmm. we realized that he still had air. His mask was still on. Let's get him out and go. So we both I had gotten up to him at this point after Andy had already done most of the packaging and we're getting ready to move him. And we try to tug and he doesn't budge. And so I said, "All right, let's do a 1-2-3 count. 1-2-3 pull." And then he starts to move. And if you can imagine, I'm on the left shoulder strap. Andy's on the right shoulder strap. We're all on all fours, and we're just basically dog walking backwards. One, two, three, pull. One, two, three, pull. So we get and we drag him about 30 feet through this mess and clutter through just a narrow path in the crawl space. We get him to the top of the steps and pass him off to Carlos Brown on the truck crew. He gets him from the top of the steps, down the steps, through the storage space, through most of the basement, through the bar area, and all of our bells start ringing. I mean, we're just completely and utterly physically and mentally exhausted and smashed. I try to pick him back up again and drag the rest of the way, and I can't. I'm too exhausted. Fortunately, the second RIT team that had been put in place we came in. They had cleared all the area furniture. They had spotlights set up, so we knew exactly where we had to go. And one of the members came in, grabbed him, and drug him the rest of the way out to his awaiting crew. And both fortunately and unfortunately, it was his own crew from 10, a fantastic group of men and women that immediately went to work on him and tried to do all the resuscitative efforts that they could. And unfortunately, he was pronounced dead later at the hospital.
Okay, so, you know, and what an amazing heroic feat. I mean, we all train, we all say we're prepared, and many of us in the fire service have fortunately never had to go to work and do it. You did. Let's talk now a little bit about the article you know, you describe the training and the aspect before this event. How much training, how would you describe, you know, Howard County's approach to RIT and the preparation?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of all over the place, and I don't mean that in a bad way. Let me kind of explain that. So
sure.
A few years prior, we were fortunate to benefit from the IAFF's Fireground Survival Program.
Very good program.
It's a great program. And just my position at the time in the union and just my general interest in it, I was kind of like one of the lead guys and just helping organize it and help the master instructors come in and get them set up. And so I just had a general interest from there. And we had, I think, close to 30 train the trainers go through the program and pass. Now, due to some budget concerns and some other logistical issues, we weren't able to get the entire department trained, but there were a large handful of people in the field that benefited from the training and could affect their own individual shifts and get them the training. And we had people, you know, it doesn't necessarily have to just be the IFF. I mean, there are plenty of private, you know, third party organizations or maybe somebody has a general interest in it, and sure, people would train themselves up and train their shifts. So we were fortunate in that we had that program and that we would train our own people on our own shifts, even if it wasn't collectively the department. And just kind of using that model that the IFF has, it was a great starting point, and it's just a great model of that, of working the basics, the crawl, walk, run that I talk about, and just advancing throughout there. And it doesn't matter what your training is. It can be RIT, it can be pulling hose lines, it can be forceful entry. Just start small and start with the fundamentals. But then we need to get to this point to where we stress ourselves. The worst thing that you could experience on the fire ground, hopefully isn't the first time. And what I mean by that is hopefully our training evolves to a point over time when everybody is truly ready that we really stress ourselves and know what failure feels like, know what the physical and mental stress feels like. So that way, when we do experience that on the fire ground, you've been there before.
Right.
You can overcome that physical and mental stress.
What were some of the, prior to this, what were some of the different scenarios or the trainings that you guys would do?
Some of it right out the gate was spinoffs of the IFF program. So it would be sending people through entanglement mazes. And, you start, eyes open and gear, but then we add gear and then we take your vision away. And then we really cinch you down and we make sure that you get entangled and trapped and have to go through the skills. There would be things with search. A lot. I'm not some training guru. I think having kids has honestly changed my perspective on things a little bit. So I would, I remember walking around my house and thinking, if somebody had to search my house right now, how would my layout or how would my kids' messes in their room affect what they were doing? So
sure.
There was one day I snuck like a bassinet into the firehouse and kind of turned the guys around by throwing like a mini crib into the firehouse.
That's or smart.
We would forcible entry. There's a lot of people out there doing it, but we would throw up plywood on either side of the forcible entry prop. We would black out all the windows in the engine bay so it was dark. And I would simulate and say, hey, we're in the stairwell of a two-story home. You're on the backside, and this is a walk-up basement, so you don't have a whole lot of room to move around in. You got people trapped on the second floor. It's 2 a.m., so it's dark. And you got engine crew behind you getting ready to put out this basement fire, and you have the forced entry. So we would do push-ups, and we would get our heart rate and breathing rate up, and then you would have to go through the skills. And granted, that's not day one. This is like day 5 and 6 after spending 4 hours per day working up to that point. So just recently we finished up some air emergency stuff. We can track some line of duties and near misses where there have been purge valve issues with your MMR and your SCBA, or maybe there's a catastrophic line that's been burnt through. And I've been in the fire service for almost 16, 17 years. And I remember this is the first time I started thinking to myself, what if that happened to me? And honestly, a lot of these things come from fear. And I want to be able to know how to manage that fear. And I want all the people that work around me to be able to do the same thing. So we all started talking like, hey, how can we better get through this problem? So we just started working air management skills. And if we have catastrophic failure, and we learned a lot over the course of a couple weeks. And by the end of it, we're doing the same thing. We're blocking out our vision. We're doing push-ups and we're running before we even get to the point where we have a failure. So we're doing this under stress, under physical and mental stress, and turning each other's bottles off and working through these emergencies.
How was it received? How was the training received? Because I think some of our listeners, and myself included, want to have this question, is that I am sometimes torn that when you don't have a lot, I am from a small department, small full-time department, 65 people, that you only get so much time to train. We're focusing on a billion other things. And you say, we're going to go through some RIT, or we have a vacant building, we're going to go through some RIT, and you want to try to smash it all into, one day or three shifts or whatever, over the cover of the three shifts. And you took a true crawl, walk, run approach, if you would. I sometimes think in the fire service, you need that, but also I think when it comes to RIT, I think firefighters need that failure in the practice when it doesn't really, when it doesn't matter, when lives are not on the line, that sometimes they need to fail to truly understand how important it is to know what you're doing, that you need that to be humbled. Some members, when I personally tried that, don't like that. Everybody wants a trophy. Everybody wants to succeed. What I mean? When I read your article, that really came to my mind, is that, would you change that crawl, walk, run to maybe put more pressure on? Or did you find that doing it this way, it really added up to a better way moving forward for other types of training?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. And there's a lot of sentiment surrounding that. And you kind of have to cater it to the shift, I think. And now granted, I'm coming from the career perspective. I also have volunteer time. I understand that, volunteers have a different set of circumstances to overcome, whether it be, you know, a duty crew, or maybe you're responding from home, whatever the case may be. But even with that, you got to step back and take a look at your shift. And I remember when I first got promoted, one of the first shifts coming to a lot of young people, and there were some people that beforehand, they didn't train a whole lot. And when I say, hey, let's go training, it would actually create fear because they thought that they were going to be judged and that they were going to be put on the chopping block. And it was going to be, how much do I know more than you?
Right.
And so step one is just removing that fear and creating an environment that everybody's on the level playing field. And I know that for some people that was really hard because we had to start with the basics. So everybody knew the expectation.
Sure.
I think that was first and foremost. And some people that really frustrated them because like, hey, I'm so much more ahead of this. Like, why aren't we doing this thing and that thing?
Right.
And you could see the other firefighters, like their eyes roll back in their head because like, we're not ready for that. So we all have to humble ourselves and say, hey, no, we need to start with the basics because that's where we're always going to revert back to. And once those start just becoming absolute second nature, you cannot get them wrong. Then we start adding those little bits of stress and then we can increase complexity. And just like high performing teams are in high stress situations, like Navy SEALs, for example,
sure,
they want their personnel to experience failure. And it's in those instances where you can really take a step back and be like, I failed at this evolution and here's why. Here's how we can pick it apart and make each other better. So I think it's okay to fail sometimes. I don't like it when it gets to the point of you're going through these scenarios and somebody's like, all right, now you got 14 houses on fire. Now you've got airplanes falling out of the sky and it's just, it doesn't become realistic anymore.
Right.
And it always frustrated me, but you make it as realistic as possible. And I think diving into NIOSH reports and near miss reports and internal service bulletins that the department's put out has been really good evidence to support some of the training we're doing because as Lawrence Gonzalez from Deep Survival says, like you're able to literally commune with the dead and you can really pick apart what happened. And even if these reports don't give every nitty gritty detail, you can be like, wait a minute, this actually has happened. This can happen to you.
Right.
And you can start to design some training evolutions just around something that has happened to somebody else.
The book you mentioned, you mentioned Lawrence Gonzalez, and for our listeners, he wrote, it's an excellent, excellent book on survival. And he writes about, you know, it's not firefighting survival, but it's just occupations and near misses, of survival. And if you have the opportunity, it's called the Deep Survival. If our listeners want to look that up, it is excellent. When it comes to two questions, is Howard County prior to this event in your career, had they ever had to put a written service for a May Day prior to this?
So I got hired in 2005, and to my knowledge in Howard County, we were always really great at having RIT teams in place.
Sure.
But to actually have them deployed, to my knowledge, I don't believe since I was working there that had actually happened. Now I could be wrong. Maybe I'm speaking out of the turn, but I don't believe so.
Sure.
Now before that, I know that there had been some situations where, we had a Swift Water incident where, a member got sucked downstream. We've had a couple fires where it was basement fires and they're in the steps and something's flashed and it's caught people. That's happened a couple times. So we have definitely had near misses, and we're members, whether it was a formal RIT team or not, have had to have been deployed. But not in the recent future.
Okay. And so the other point I want you to highlight is we talk in the article about your unit cohesion and how important that is. And, I think that's a great point. If you would kind of elaborate in your own words, how important that was that night, and moving forward for, you know, how important that was, that you work together, you train together, the takeaways from that.
Yeah. Man, I am so fortunate that I get to work with the men and women at Seven, that I do. They are so dedicated to the craft, and I'm a better person because of them. And we have worked, at the time, we had all worked together for a pretty long time. As a firefighter, I'd been in and out of Seven because of other assignments, and I was fortunate to come back as a lieutenant. And so for a lot of those people, we had worked together for many years. And the senior firefighter on the shift, Carlos Brown, he said it really well. When we got the green light to go in, he said it was amazing to hear. The only thing you heard was everybody's regulators clicking. You heard seven men click into their regulator, and we all filed in single file. And he said that that was amazing. And it just is kind of a nod to how well we worked together, because at the time I was a 13-year lieutenant, and there was an almost 30-year captain. We don't have to bark orders. We never had to bark orders. Everybody knew exactly what they had to do, and they did their job. And because we had worked so long together and so well together, and we have trained so much together, everybody knew what the expectation was. And we all knew what roles individually we had, and we knew what the other person was going to be doing. So wow. That unit cohesion was absolutely paramount. So that's all you heard. Rarely were words ever uttered throughout that entire incident among all of us, because we all just knew and we trusted each other. And he said it best. So to have that level of security and to have that level of trust is something that has to be cultivated over a period of days and months and years. And it's through training, and it's through spending time in the firehouse together. And I know not all firehouses and all stations and shifts can necessarily benefit from that. You know, in the ages of budget cuts, you know, firefighters sure. getting detailed all over the place, and you know, cuts in staffing. These are real things that happen. We were fortunate that we didn't have really many details in or out that day. It was our core shift, and yeah, like I said, it was something that was built over a period of years. And you see in NOSH reports, people, you know, acting officers or people acting out yep. of positions, detail crews, overtime shifts, you know, being tired for working 48 hours straight. You know, we didn't really have that at play that evening. And I absolutely think that was part of our success that night. And, you know, when we're off, you know, we have a shift party coming up in a couple weeks. And so we spend time outside the firehouse together, where we can decompress and our families can get together. And, you know, you go to shifts and like, you guys get together on your off days. Like we don't do that. We don't even talk to, we don't, to call each right. other, nothing. So I work at just a very special place, and I'm so fortunate. We're all better because of each other. And that absolutely played into our success that night. That cannot be understated.
Well, you mentioned, and that is a highlight, and the takeaways are many, but the unit togetherness is really, I think I've been on, so I started my 32nd year, and I don't.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I know, I'm an old fart, but.
no, that's awesome. Congrats.
But my father was on the job, and when I look back, it is different. It is different. I hate saying yeah. that word, but you have that rare. It's a perfect example of, you know, years ago and in my father's day, they did more together as a group, and they were that true team, and it has died out. And right or wrong, good or bad, I just think it's just, you know, it's just a different time. Different people are just different. You have different, you're busy, and you're just different places. And so that rarity that you have is an example of, that's a good thing. And to maybe try doing it again, because it's not just RIT operations that you would succeed. It's stretching hose lines, operating at a pin job, whatever it is. If yeah. you have that togetherness, you are way ahead of the curve. And there are many, many, many thousands of firehouses across the world, certainly in the United States, where it's fractured. Everybody just wants to come in, go home, don't bother me. And you escape day in and day out, not having to truly perform. And when you have to, it's either a success or failure. And you can get by and get lucky, but if there's a failure, I think that's a little dark secret that nobody talks about. That could be part of NIOSH reports or reports of that togetherness or being able to work that cohesion.
You're absolutely right. I think we're really quick to paint it with a broad brushstroke or, yeah, like you said, kind of gloss over it really quickly. And then we get to kind of the meat and potatoes. But even if you get outside the fire service, which I think is a good thing, you know, look at other industries, look at sports psychology, and
sure,
you can just see how important the team performance side of it is. I know when I came into the fire service, you know, they looked at my generation as like, oh my God, these young guys, you know, we can't teach them, we can't do anything with them. And now I'm like I said, 16 years in, and you look at the people coming in, and sometimes you hear people around you saying, oh my God, this new generation and the millennials and this and that. And I kind of laugh as like, we can benefit from each other, and we just need to have some very clear expectations of what we all want and need. And then we can all grow from each other. We have to, if we sit still and stagnant, and I'm still learning, I'm still trying to figure out how to do that and grow and become better. But, no matter what generation is coming in or is still in or is on their way out, whatever, we have to learn from each other. We still have to provide the service to the community, and it has to be awesome service. So, yeah, there's nothing saying that we can't learn from each other, but still have expectations that we're all grounded to.
As we wrap this up, how do you think you talked in your article about the role that physical conditioning and physical fitness, which is very important. You know, I mean, I think I'm a shift commander, and I look back at the assistant chief sets the rank of my shift commander in my department, that as I look back on my assistant chiefs growing into the job and years ago, that they would go, wait a minute, you want time to work out? Come on. And now, yeah. Right. And you know, get out there and turn hydrants or do those inspections or clean the station. But now it's part, I think we have to accept it as part of the duty day. It's part of the day. How would have this, it's unfortunate that it turned out the way it did. It was a fatality, and it's not good. But in your opinion, how would you think this would have turned out if you guys weren't in that kind of shape, or would have things, you know, whether it's this particular event or any other event, can you talk a little bit about the importance of staying in shape?
Sure. Yeah. No, I know the guys I work with are rolling their eyes right now, cause I'm about to get on my soapbox. It's something very near and dear to me. And, I've been a trainer I'm in my 10th year as a fitness trainer, and my first love is CrossFit and high intensity interval training. And CrossFit aside, we could not have done what we did that night had we not trained physically the way that we had been. And I know the analogy that I use a lot is, if you're a marathon runner, that's awesome, but there's a hole in your fitness. And if you're a bodybuilder or a power lifter, you also have a fantastic foundation, but there's still a hole in our fitness.
Sure.
We need to be able to complete, you know, move large loads, long distances, and do it really quickly. Simply put, and that's kind of like a coined term in the CrossFit community, but we need to be able to complete a lot of work very quickly. And we're doing that in limited ranges of motion with our gear. And we have a finite amount of air. And it's not just me. It's my 200-pound frame plus all my gear plus the person that I need to potentially save, whether that's a civilian or a fully dressed out firefighter. Yeah. And that's it's something that I think we're doing better with as in the fire service in general. There's more research, you know, 50% of our line of duties are cardiac related, and that is absolutely preventable. Yeah. So we absolutely have to change our training. One of the things that I mentioned was, by the time we had made it out of the crawl space, so maybe we're 13 minutes into the actual rescue, all of our bells started ringing. We hit our low air alarm, and most crews, when you look at the BA data from that fire that night, or and then from other fires in general in our area, most of the BA data does not look like the station I come from. And
sure,
to kind of fluff those guys up, man, they sure. they train and they work hard, and so they were able to extend their air. We, by the time we got out of the structure and got out with Flynn, some of the reports from eyewitness accounts and from burn data is showing that within 60 seconds to 2 minutes after we exited, the entire crawl space that we were in collapsed.
Wow.
So when you think that my backup guy, who was our recruit, but was incredibly well trained and came with a good bit of experience, if he hadn't managed every single turn in that line well, if we had spent more time in the entanglement scenario, if I did not work within 95% of my max effort and just got a little lazy, every single person had a job to do and they did fantastic. But if our fitness wasn't up to par with our training, this could have been a body recovery for seven other men.
Right.
And I don't want to like Monday night quarterback my own incident, but we're occupational athletes and we have an expectation that the community places on us. And I don't think it's unreasonable. So I have some really cool data in some of the presentations that I do from the fire that night and from others just in the industry around the fire service of watching people who go in Maydays, their air volume gets shot quickly. And some of the data that we were able to pull from our crews that night, it showed a nice, very steady, natural decline in our air consumption through one of the worst, most stressful physically and emotionally instance you could possibly go through. And I absolutely credit that to our physical fitness that evening.
A lot of firemen they're kidding themselves that they think that they're ready. And you truly were as prepared as you could be. I want to thank you. I it's an incredible story. How has this changed you personally, if you don't mind?
The department has been so incredibly supportive of just getting information out there. I know it's not always at the speed that some people like to see it, but the ISRB made a ton of recommendations and we're kind of chipping away at them, and they've made a bunch. You know, all of our staffing is up to 4 personnel now throughout the entire county. We've made radio changes. We're going through BA changes. You know, I know sometimes it's a slow moving process, but we're working on it. And I know for me specifically in our shift, it's changed our core values. It changes the way we do riding assignments. It changes the way we train. I thought I was dedicated to training before. I don't ever want to beat my guys up and spend 4 hours a day training out in the hot sun, but we're going to do something every shift. And we're going to work on making ourselves better, even if that means revisiting something we've already done, which is totally fine, and still getting a workout in. And then just getting outside of the fire service, having, I don't mean to sound cheesy, but having that greater appreciation for life. It wasn't something that the firefighters just experienced. I came home to my wife and 2 little girls, and there's a lot of people on my shift that went home to that. And our wives and our spouses throughout the department went through that in a way that most people don't realize until you're in that situation. I say that I could do an entire presentation just on from the time you get to the hospital and then that next 48 hours after, all the things you never would have thought you would go through, just between phone calls and decisions you have to make and things you have to deal with and questions you have to answer. It's very daunting, but like I said, we've had an incredibly supportive department. I work with incredible men and women, you know, up and down the chain. And I just have an incredible wife and kids at home that help support me too in all this craziness. So it's all been for good.
Is the reception to the report, how has it been? Was there negativity surrounding it, or how has it embraced and have the changes been implemented?
Yeah, Yeah, great question. I think by and large, it was very well received. And similar to what Prince William County did for the Kyle Wilson report, I think we can kind of try to model that. We really, the ISRB just did a really great job of kind of the pointing the finger back at ourselves and being like, where did we mess up? What can we change? What can we do? And you know that's going to ruffle some feathers. But to get true, real growth, you have to have those hard conversations. And so this is happening on a much larger scale, but we're really trying to go through the growing pains of becoming better. And it's going to be an awkward, weird process at times. But when you are honest with yourselves and you can do it in a respectful way and bring each other up and do it with a lot of humility, a healthy dose of humility,
sure,
you can do some really great stuff. So like I said, we're going through the process. I know it's not always at the speed and pace that some people want to have it. I know one of the frustrating things for me is that we've had people come into our shift on details or trades and be like, hey, so what about this thing? Or I heard that. And it's incredibly obvious that people have not spent the time reading the report or asking the right questions. They hear a rumor and they just leave it at that. And they don't do the research for themselves. And that goes back to just what we do in general. Like we have to police ourselves in a healthy way. You know, we have to do the diligent work in reading reports and asking the right questions and learning from this and not just taking it at face value. So I know that can be frustrating for me and some of the other people I work with when people, what if, and Monday Night Quarterback, and it's really obvious that they didn't read the report.
Right. It's easier to shoot holes than it is to actually get in, you know, and learn.
It takes work. Takes work and time. And like I said, I'm not sure when this is going to actually get published, but on the anniversary, the second year anniversary here in a couple weeks, Howard County has started an annual Nate Flynn Training Days where I'm going to do my presentation on the writ, and I can really, I can spend 90 minutes really diving into the whole incident and scenario and all the little things we didn't get to turn over. And that's going to be a free online event that's coming up. But again, the NIOSH report is coming and that I'm sure will open some more eyes and I'm going to learn more from that. Adam St. John, you cannot walk away from that guy and not learn something.
Right.
He's just got incredible information and whenever he's able to complete his fire modeling and his presentation, it's going to be amazing. It's going to do great things, I think, for the fire service in general. And again, the ISRB is out there. And it's 400 or 500 pages of free information. So there's a lot out there that we can all benefit from. And the information's out there. We just have to do the due diligence and put in some work and spend some time reading and listening. Hey, Jay, you still there?
Yep, I am here. I'm sorry.
It's okay.
As we wrap things up here, how can people get a hold of you if they want you to discuss the event, do an online or whatever? How can people get in touch with you to discuss this further?
Yeah, I'm not somebody who has like crazy Instagram pages or Facebook. I don't have my own company or anything. I'm just a dude. So the email is probably best. It's Josh Burchick, BURCHICK @gmail.com. Okay. I've gotten a lot of feedback from there and you can shoot me a message through social media and as I can, I'll definitely respond back to you. And any questions? I'm really open to just getting information out there. So whoever has anything.
How can people find out? You mentioned on the 2-year anniversary, you'll be doing a free online class for Nathan. How can people get information on that if they want to do that?
Yeah, so I just found out within the last couple of days it's being shared a lot of places. So Howard County Maryland Fire and Rescue Facebook page. I think the registration link, it's a free registration link through Eventbrite. It's on the main page, but I think fire engineering and firefighter close calls and a lot of other fire service industries have already started sharing it. So,
Perfect.
The information's out there.
Perfect. I'm signed up for it and I hope that,
this gets out before then and more people tune into that and contact you. Josh, it's been a pleasure. You are you're a real firefighter, and no, you are. And it's members like you that I enjoy doing this and getting your name out there, your recognition, and your story. And for that, I thank you, and thanks for coming on in their own words.
Well, no, thank you so much.